Welcome to the snooze button. Hey, I'm Brittany of Brittany, She, and Sleep. I've got 99 problems, but my kid sleeping isn't one.
Hi, guys. Hey, we have a very, very cool guest with us today. I am honored to have Myra Sachs here. So Myra is mother, wife. She's the author of 57 Fridays, the last book I've read, and one of the first books I have finished in several months, which is 57 Fridays, Losing Our Daughter, Finding Our Way. And she's the founder of eMotion, Inc., which is a nonprofit that's devoted to changing the way we show up for people who are grieving. So Myra, thank you so much for being here.
It's an honor, Brittany. Thank you.
Yay. I'm so excited. Okay. Well, there's like so many things I want to talk to you about. I kind of alluded to this before, but I feel like I'm talking to a celebrity a little bit because I feel like the book, you just had such a way of like bringing us into your experience. And when I told you, when your sister-in-law DM'd me yesterday thanking me for talking to you, I was like, oh my God, one of the sibs is talking to me. This is so cool. So tell us a little bit about, obviously, you know, why you wrote this book, but a little bit about your daughter Javi's story so that people understand what it's all about.
Thanks, Brittany. And the sibs are definitely the coolest. They intimidate me in that way. Javi is our first daughter. She was born 2 years to the day of our wedding anniversary. Her name actually comes from Hebrew. It means life. And when she was born, she was seemingly healthy and strong and beautiful. She had these big, gorgeous eyes that Matt, my husband, and I could never quite figure out what exact color they were. We actually got into a little dispute about whether they were green or hazel, or when we were trying to fill out a passport application. But needless to say, they were mesmerizing. And we spent the first year of parenthood, I think, in some ways, like many parents, exhausted, in love, confused. And ultimately just having our world turned upside down in the most beautiful way and the most unexpected way. And then at about a year, a little before a year, we started noticing that Javi wasn't meeting milestones, and Matt and I both really tried to keep our type A tendencies at bay, and just sort of go with it and roll with the fact that Javi would get there and sort of catch up, and that there was nothing else going on to be worried about. And then at a year, we had her appointment with a pediatrician, and she was diagnosed with developmental delay, which we were reassured was really actually quite typical, and that that with physical therapy and occupational therapy and plenty of support, Javi would make progress. And at that appointment, she also referred us to neurology just to make sort of super sure that there was nothing else going on from a genetic perspective. And basically that kicked off a diagnostic odyssey that ultimately resulted in a fatal diagnosis of Tay-Sachs disease, which was a disease that we had been tested for in preconception genetic testing, but unfortunately a fatal physician error sort of revealed itself once we got Javi's diagnosis. And that was December 17th, 2019, and everything changed. And we entered this, I think it's Kate Bowler, the theologian, says, you know, apocalyptic time, where that comes from the Greek word, which means to lay bare or to reveal itself, when sort of we all of a sudden entered this world with one foot in the land of the living and one in the land of the dead. And that's sort of the space we operate from now.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, it's such a, obviously an insanely heavy thing that you guys experienced, and not everyone will go through something like this, will be a bereaved parent or will know someone who's bereaving a child. But I wanted to touch a little bit on how you guys navigated that and how you rallied your community and your family around you, because I think this is so relatable to what in different ways, where it's not a competition about what's the saddest or the worst, but everyone goes through things, and finding ways to cope and to manage the really hard times is so important. And you guys did an unbelievable job. So I would love to hear if you could just tell people more about that. about what you guys did at that point.
Yeah. And I love what you just said. And when we talk about emotion, which is the organization I started, one of our values is this notion of connecting, not comparing. And it's this idea of avoiding the Lost Olympics, which is, you know, if you win the Lost Olympics, you're somehow standing on this podium that no one else in the history of humanity has ever stood on before. And that's lonely. And if you lose the Lost Olympics, you somehow feel like your loss isn't as big, immense, cutting, deep as the person next to you. And that's a really minimizing space to be. So I think ultimately sort of learning how to connect at the level of each of our pains is a lesson that I take with me and try to move with every day. And our community, and you alluded to the SIBs earlier, but our community really became foundational to us in the way that we were able to move with this devastation. And I think too often in the context of loss, and if we think about loss in the most expanded definition of the term, really grief is just the human response to moving with something that is big and immeasurable and painful. And how we move with that ultimately determines how we're able to sort of survive. And so for us, those anchors became community, which was a group of friends and close family who really rallied around us and saw Javi as not scary, but sacred. And some of our family was able to move a couple of blocks away from us and sort of be as proximate as possible to Javi in her short life. And others supported us from a distance. And that sort of spectrum of showing up, you know, if we think about one end of the spectrum as like authentic contacts and sort of text messages or notes or just words of affirmation that the person or the experience matters to you as someone who's trying to show up, is ultimately the greatest gift to a parent or a person, that your child's life matters to them. And then on the other end of the spectrum, I think, is this notion of emotional dwelling, which comes from Robert Stolaro's work. And that's this sort of sharing of emotional and physical space, this like full inhabitation of grief and love. And ultimately, that's what so much of our community was able to do with and for us. And that took the form of what we ended up calling these Shabirthdays, which were, and the name of the book, 57 Fridays, comes from this concept that came to us. I couldn't, as a mom, wrap my head around the fact that Javi would only have two birthdays on this earth. And yet we knew we always had Fridays. We knew that Shabbat was going to come every Friday. And so we sort of cooked up this concept of, what if we combined Javi's birthday with Shabbat and called them Shabirthdays? And could we find a way to live from one Shabirthday to the next? And on each of those Fridays, we would honor Javi. We would celebrate her. We wouldn't throw a party and pretend like our life wasn't upside down and filled with anguish and sorrow. But we would be with each other, and we would cry, and we would listen to music, and we would dance, and we would eat. And that sort of reliance on ritual became another really important component to our grieving and healing that we continue to do today.
Yeah. And it's such a powerful thing that you did. And one thing that really I found moving and like brave of you was, there was at one point early in the book after the diagnosis, I think you guys, and correct me if I'm misremembering this, you guys had gone to a rabbi and you had presented this idea, and he or she was kind of like, I wouldn't do that. You know, like they were kind of like, don't celebrate. I don't know what their pushback exactly was, but basically I was very like angry for you that somebody would tell you how to grieve. And I think until you've been in that place, you have no business telling someone how to feel something that's horrific for them. And I'm curious if you experienced at all in that year, and maybe even now, because you alluded to your posse, as I believe you called them in the SIBs, and everybody like cherishing Javi and and finding her sacred, not being scared of her. And I do think that some people are scared of sad people and they're scared of death, and like something like that would distance them. And I'm curious if you experienced that with any friends or family and how you navigated people like not getting it and maybe distancing themselves from you when you actually needed them the most.
The rabbi moment was a threshold one for us, because ultimately, in hindsight, what her response represented, which you captured beautifully, is that she was afraid. She was operating from a fear of place. She was afraid of what it would mean for us when Javi died and we no longer had her on these Shabbat days. Right. And so ultimately, that's why she sort of advised against this concept. And I'm so grateful that we had the conviction to ignore that and to realize that actually doing just the opposite, that leaning into the most painful thing ultimately was what allowed all of this depth and beauty that still sustains me today to emerge. And I think as it relates to people, other people in our lives who couldn't show up, some of that I think is about not having language and really sort of operating frameworks to be with people who are in anguish. And you're right in that we live in a culture where sort of distancing from things that are hard and heavy and painful is sort of the status quo. And as a result, we don't have education or literacy on topics like grief and loss. And so I don't think that the absence of people in my life or some of the harmful or less helpful comments ever came from a place of malintent. I think they really come from a place of not knowing and a place of really being afraid of their own pain. And so things we experienced were, you know, at least you can have other children. You know, I'm just going to sort of turn and I see you, meaning I see you, Myra and Matt, you know, walking down the street with Javi in the stroller, but I'm going to turn the other way because I can't look you in the eyes because it's too painful for me. And that sort of self-orientation that makes the sort of S, so to speak, in self-orientation so big, we lose the capacity to actually just be with someone who needs us. And that's sort of now what I'm after, is how do we change the way people think about being there for grieving people? And it's so rare, Brittany, for someone like you to say yes to someone like me, which is ultimately the first step to all of this, you know, to normalize and to not make grieving people feel like aliens.
Totally. And it like breaks my heart that you're even saying that, because that was when your story was brought to me and your friend Rachel brought it to me as my client. That was my first reaction, is like, this sounds so awful. And like, I'm afraid what I'm going to do right now. I'm afraid I'm going to cry. I'm an empath, you know? And then I had like 2 seconds later, I was like, oh my God, Brittany, put your effing big girl pants on. Like, this mom lived this experience. You can't read her freaking book and talk to her. Like, give me a break. And I'm so glad I did. And I hope that this is an impetus for other people to make that decision too, because I feel like a better mom, a better person, and have a deeper understanding of something just because I read that book. Like, I think it's, I said on my Instagram yesterday, I was like, every parent should read this. If you're in a place mentally, and I get, I probably wouldn't have done it if I was pregnant or something. Like, I understand that there are places we're in where you have your own emotional issues, but it's so important that people know these things. And I think I'm curious exactly with emotion, what you guys do to help people like me who have not gone through something like this, to be able to show up for people who need them.
We run what we call grief literacy training programs that range from 60 to 90 minutes, like a very basic course that we call Showing Up. And that's sort of grounded in psychoeducation around grief and loss, and then present some frameworks around how to show up and make suggestions around real language and sort of some real scenarios that folks can play with. And then we have trainings that are much more in depth. So for people who really want to lean in or are leading or managing lots of people who are experiencing all sorts of loss, we offer more in depth day-long or multi-day experiences for people to sort of understand and start to get comfortable with this language of loss so they can support their teams and their communities. And then we, for primary grievers, we offer something called these movement communities, which are 10-week experiences that are movement-based and sort of have these gently guided grief contemplations and reflection prompts that sort of go with the different movement activities. And those are communities of 10 to 15 people, and they're led by grieving people themselves who are trained in emotion. And so those movement communities now exist in Boston and Maine and now LA. And that's really a grassroots movement that is hopefully sort of a for grievers, by grievers type of thing.
I love that. So that's a community of people who are grieving. They can be together with like a facilitator. Yeah. I love that. That's I'm not sure if you've heard of them, but after my dad passed, I became involved with this organization called Comfort Zone Camp, and it's for kids who are bereaving. So if it's for children who've lost a parent or a sibling, I believe, and they go to this camp, it's like a summer camp, but it's a summer camp, just to your point, where they're not treated like aliens, like, oh, that's so sad, your mom died of cancer or whatever. And it's all other kids who have gone through the same thing. And I think most of the volunteers, but that was at my wedding, instead of having a favor, that's what we did. We gave a donation to them and, you know, in honor of all of the guests.
Wow.
But I think the concept is so cool.
Oh my gosh, I love that. What a gift you are to have made that your wedding favor, man. It's amazing. Like,
nobody needs a little doily of some type. Nobody wants that stuff. Let's make this somewhat impactful. But I love that, the aspect of community, you know, because I was also in reading the book, I was struck by and I mentioned this to you earlier, like, pick the right person to marry, right? Because you could be going through things that you do not plan. And, you know, we all say for better or for worse, but when worst happens, like, do you have someone by your side that can stand with you through it? And not everyone does. And not everyone has loving, caring family that can support them, you know, or the means to go on all these incredible adventures you guys did with Javi. So the idea that there is a community maybe outside of people you know that you could connect with and be with in a hard time is so cool. So I love that you guys do that. Sounds great.
Thank you. Yeah, that's exactly the idea, is how do we curate that community that I know I was so fortunate to have, and how do we create that for others so that community is really a right for grieving people. And then the sort of training for folks who aren't primary grievers is meant to say, let's not pathologize grievers and just sort of cordon them off into their own little communities, but instead let's integrate them into communities of people who have known and loved them forever. And you know, I didn't want to make a whole new set of friends who were only bereaved parents.
So
I wanted
true.
My friends, you know, and my family. And and I have made otherworldly connections, and I'm tragically grateful for the depths of friendship that I have with other bereaved parents. But I think we often miss the part that we just want to be loved and known and integrated into the communities that have always been so important to us.
So I'm curious, with that said, because I think there really is, and I don't know if you agree, I think there's a really big difference in how people, the comfort people feel showing up for someone going through who's, you know, grieving, when it's like an adult versus a child. I think it's really different. And I think people are much easier for people to be like, I'm so sorry. And I'm saying this from someone whose dad died when she was 22. I think people, it's easier for them to say, I'm sorry, and to want to talk about and tell me about your dad and to show me a picture. I think it's different than saying you lost a child. And I'm curious, what what should everyone listening know? If you know someone going through this, either their child is very sick, you know, their child has leukemia or something, they don't know if they're going to make it or not, or they have lost or know they will lose them. What do those parents at a high level want to hear and see from their community? Like, what could we all do for them? Or mistakes we don't want to make, things we don't want to say.
Ultimately, as parents, I think we just want to know that our kids belong, that they matter, that they are loved, that they are a part of this crazy, beautiful, scary world. And for grieving parents, either parents whose child died or is dying, people who want to know our children ultimately are the ones who make us feel seen and supported. And so I don't think it ever hurts to figure out what are the things that make that child who they are, and how do you, as a supporter, a friend, a family member, share that back with a parent. And so an example of that might be, for Javi, her favorite color was purple, and we really associate lavender with her. And so anytime a friend or a stranger shares a note or a photo of lavender, or wears a purple sock even, and says, "Hey, I'm bringing Javi to work today," like, that changes my day. And that is more than enough. And so I think knowing and showing that we all genuinely want to know these children and believe that they are forces for good is the greatest gift you can give a parent. I think things that are hard to hear are acts of distancing, like we talked about. And those acts of distancing are often things that either minimize pain. Usually saying "at least" is just like not a good plan, because "at least" inherently is minimizing. But other things, you know, like even saying "I can't imagine" can be distancing, because again, it sort of sends the message like, "I can't imagine, I'm out of here. Like, this is just too much for me," you know, versus right. When I try to imagine, like you described, like when I try to imagine, you know, my throat wells up and I feel like I can't swallow, and I like can't find the words, and "I'm so sorry that you're experiencing this." That's ultimately an act of like leaning in, and that I think is really sustaining or has been sustaining for me.
Yeah, that makes total sense. I mean, the biggest message I'm getting really is like not to treat this situation like with kid gloves so much. Not to be like, "Sorry, I can't imagine. I can drop off food later. Here's a DoorDash gift certificate." It's like kind of, it's like maybe come over and hold Javi and talk to her. Maybe give her an outfit, because she's still wearing clothes and she would like something cute to wear, right? It's like, so totally. Can I ask then, will you tell us one really special or fun story about Javi? Because I feel like she's a celebrity and I am obsessed with her now. So everyone needs to be too.
Oh gosh, that's such a beautiful question. I love that so much. Yeah. I think the Javi story that I would share is that we ended up having a good night routine, which I know so many parents have. And ours was grounded in something that we called "Goodnight to the Bay." And we would say "Goodnight to the Bay." And we were living at the time in California on Tamales Bay, kind of trapped in this cottage. And Javi never made really a friend who was her age. But she became really connected to kind of the natural world that we lived in. And so we and she found great comfort in saying goodnight to the bay and the otters and the swallows and sort of all the creatures who came to know and love Hav. And my sister ended up turning our Goodnight to the Bay routine. Matt and I would hold Javi. We would alternate. I would say the first few lines and Matt would be holding her, and then we would switch. And my sister ended up turning that into a children's book that we only have, you know, we have a copy. And I think that that's my Javi story, because ultimately she was someone who just generated so much goodness and thoughtfulness and creativity and love in others. And I think that's sort of what anchors me in my day to day, is what are ways in which these seemingly mundane goodnight routines can end up becoming sort of catalysts for beautiful, bigger representations of what it means to be generous and loving for our family and friends and broader community of people we don't know.
Yeah, I love that. And there's nothing better than a good bedtime routine, obviously. But yeah, I think like what a legacy, right? To bring out the best in other people, to spark their creativity. And that's a lasting impact, right? Like, she positively changed, I'm sure, so many people's lives and made them think about life differently. I'm sure the same is true for you guys, right? You just look at life differently. I'm curious if specifically, because you have two other wonderful kids as well, I know the answer is yes, but I'm curious in what ways your experience with Javi changed how you see the world as a parent, and like how you parent Kaya and Ezra.
Yeah, Kaya, I'll tell a Kaya story that maybe represents the ways in which we integrate Javi and also try to parent Kaya and Ezra, which is that a few nights ago, I was putting Kaya to bed, and she said, Mom, I'm gonna tuck Javi in extra tight into my heart tonight. And I got kind of teary, and she's gonna be four at the end of June. And then 3 seconds later, she said, Mom, I'm gonna tuck Javi into my tissue box with all my other special things. And I started to laugh. And ultimately, I think that's sort of where Kaya is and what it's like to parent a four-year-old whose older sister is dead, which is that she's not yet at the developmental age where she really understands that death is permanent. She sees so much life in death. She sees and talks about Javi as her sister in a way that puts even me at ease. And I think that there's so much to be learned and gained from where she is and how she honors and includes Javi in her life, that we take our lead from her, and we try to not impose our sort of scary adult perspectives onto her, because I think that's probably the worst thing we could do. And right. Ezra will be two in August, so he points to photos of Javi and says her name, but obviously he has no sort of other language for her. And we will be faced with lots of challenges around how to parent living children whose sibling died. And we will stay open to learning and growing and changing as they do, and try not to be afraid and try to give their big feeling space, even when it crushes me and breaks my heart. And I think as a parent, I don't know, this is obviously, it's motherhood reimagined for me. I never imagined that I would have given birth to a child who then died less than 2.5 years later. And yet here I am. And so I think what that has taught me is just that there is so much uncertainty in our life, and that we have so little control, really, And ultimately, what that means is that all we can do is lean into experiences and spend time with people and say yes to things that have real meaning to us. And only we can know whether we're being honest with ourselves about if we're living in accordance to sort of our deepest values. And I'd be lying if I say that I do that every day. I default into all of my old ways and impatience and sort of the everyday acts of life get to me as much as they did before Javi. But I think my recovery time, the time that it takes me to sort of realize that I am spinning out on something that is superficial, is maybe much quicker.
I mean, I can't imagine. I can imagine the extra layer that you experience. Cause I think every mom, we all have mom guilt. We all have all these things, but the extra layer of when I have moments of being impatient with my kids and I stop myself and I'm like, one day you're going to miss them all talking to you at the same time. Cause I have three little ones as well. And you know, they're sometimes they'll cry at the same time. And I'm like, oh my God, this is insane. And then I'm like, Brittany, stop. One day you're going to wish somebody came into the bathroom when you had to pee. But having the extra layer of, I'm sure you have that thing of being like, why am I getting annoyed at Ezra? I wish Javi could be here doing the same thing, right? So I'm sure it takes just a layer of having so much extra grace for yourself because you're a human being. Like, tragedy doesn't make you immune to like noticing you weren't invited to someone's Christmas cocktail party. You know, it's like you're still a human. So I get it.
Yes. Yes. So well said. Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for being here, Myra. And everyone, please go pick up a copy of 57 Fridays. I'm going to put a link in the show notes. You can also visit Emotion. It's emotion-mc.org for access to Myra's full library of grief literacy programs and offerings. And there's a link there as well to buy your own copy of the book. So I hope everyone's able to check it out. And thank you so much for coming and sharing your story, Javi's story. And I hope everyone's takeaway here is people who are bereaved are not aliens. They don't want you to turn your stroller around and walk away. They want you to come over and say hi.
Brittany, thank you so much. You are a gift, and I appreciate you trusting me with your incredible community of parents. So thank you.
Thanks so much for being here. Bye.
Loving the snooze button? Be sure to subscribe so you don't miss a single episode. And please leave a review. I will read it and internalize it, so make sure it's very glowing. If you're interested in working with me or learning more about my courses, head to brittanysheehan.com or follow me on Instagram at brittanysheehansleep.